Welcome back to Vanguardia America. This is your host, James Garcia. We're going to interview now the Democratic candidate for Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, the elected office that basically oversees public schools in the state. She is an incumbent. This is Kathy Hoffman, who's been in the office now for 4 years, and before that was a teacher. And so came straight out of the classroom, right into campaigning for elected office and managed to get herself elected and has been in that office now through some pretty trying times, needless to say, the least of which, of course, included the whole period in which we have had to deal with COVID and the ramifications of COVID. Kathy, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy campaign schedule to speak to us for a few minutes.
Thank you so much, James.
So I would like to just start by asking you sort of the basic question, why do you want to be reelected?
Well, of course, I didn't take this decision lightly. The past couple of years have been among the most challenging for public education, but I started my career as an educator. I worked in preschool, and then I worked in special education as a speech therapist in our public schools. And so I've been dedicated to public education my entire career. And now I'm a new mom. And so as I think about my priorities going forward, I do have a new sense of urgency around these issues, making sure that, you know, as my daughter's getting ready for preschool and then eventually kindergarten, want to make sure that the vision I have for her classrooms is what I have for all Arizona kids, which is having highly effective teachers, making sure our schools are well-resourced with the tools that our kids need to be successful for the modern day and beyond and for their future success as part of becoming citizens of Arizona. So I'm very passionate about this work and love what we've been able to accomplish over the past couple of years, even despite the pandemic.
So you're vested in this world, not just as someone who's been a teacher and has had to stand in front of a classroom and guide children and so forth, but now you have a child that is eventually going to go into this system. Presumably you're going to stick around Arizona for a number of years and that child will grow into the system. So yeah, so you have a direct vested interest. Tell us then, you know, we have so many challenges right now with regards to public schools in Arizona. We have the fact that we're kind of at the bottom of the rung in terms of per pupil spending, that our teachers get paid some of the lowest salaries in the country. We have now this new voucher program, which presumably is going to siphon off substantial amounts of money from the coffers in general, which will make it harder, I presume, to get money for public schools. And then the pandemic fallout. We just saw, of course, in the news, a lot of reports about scores and just how our students are doing in terms of math and reading, et cetera. Those are just enormous challenges. So what are the kinds of things that you intend to do in this next term to directly impact those challenges?
Well, you're exactly right. We do have immense challenges in public education in Arizona. And, you know, even since the beginning of my first term, I've been very focused on addressing these challenges. And so one of the priorities that I will be continuing to focus on is teacher recruitment and retention. And Arizona teachers need to have competitive pay for that to be a profession in which the next generation of teachers is even that it, we want to make sure it even appeals to them that are thinking about the teacher workforce. So as we think about that second term, I want to be continuing the work I'm doing to support our teachers, to be fighting for competitive pay from the legislature, along with healthcare benefits. You know, our teachers, also just like everyone, the healthcare needs are just keep going up and up and up, and inflation keeps going up. And so we need to make sure that our teacher salaries can keep up with that and be competitive so that our teachers can also afford housing and can provide for their family. So I do think supporting our teachers must be one of our top priorities. Also looking ahead.
Before you go on, how do you get them more pay? Because you're fighting against traditionally in recent years what's been a legislature that is not coughing up money for them. It just doesn't seem to be on their radar. So you're fighting some really counter forces. How do you convince the legislature and the next governor to actually start to raise their pay?
Well, I do think, fortunately, there is some bipartisan support around raising pay for teachers and the main reason is that it's because our communities, our parents continue to advocate for that. And so part of my strategy going into my second term will be actually leveraging the voices from the community, from our business community, and bringing them to the table, because it can't just be teachers saying that we need a pay raise that, you know, maybe might not go over as well as having everyone all together, having recognition that right now, Arizona average teacher pay is well below our neighboring states. So if you look to Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, they all have average teacher pay well over $10,000 more than in Arizona. So I do think we need to look at this collectively and to keep working with the legislature. One win that we had this past year with the legislature was they added over $800 million of new funding for public education. That included funding for school safety along with special education. So that was a substantial bump towards our public schools, that, and that funding can be put towards teacher raises and operational needs. The challenge is just getting that dollars moving quickly, and then also the fact that our districts are facing the aggregate expenditure limit issue, which I've been calling on the legislature and governor to call a special session, because with this spending cap, if it's not suspended or repealed, then our school districts will be facing a 16% cut in their school funding. So that's making it really hard for them to feel comfortable in spending down their state funding when they're worried that in a couple of months, and the deadline is March 1st, if the legislature doesn't take action, then we would see over $1.3 billion cut from our public district schools.
Yeah, and that's something that has to happen that would happen in the next administration, whomever the governor ends up being. The idea, though, that you could go to a neighboring state, New Mexico, where, you know, comparatively speaking, the cost of living is probably not that much higher, and get paid thousands more to be a teacher, that has to be kind of disheartening for teachers here in Arizona. Do you hear that from them, sort of talking about, you know, how hard it is to stay in the profession?
I do hear that. And it's issues like the pay. It's also the issues of large classroom sizes, and even the recent attacks from, especially from Republicans, attacks about CRT, or even attacks on social emotional learning, banning books, like these types of culture war issues that are becoming part of our state laws. Our teachers feel like their work is under attack and that they're losing some of the respect from our lawmakers. But when I talk to Arizona voters, and when I'm going door to door calling people and I'm asking them about what their thoughts are on public education, time and time again, they say we need to treat our teachers better. We want to give our teachers a raise. So I truly feel that the Arizonans care about the quality of our schools. We've seen that time and time again, with the Invest in Ed that did pass by the voters, passed that initiative to add more funding to our schools, over $1 billion. But then that ultimately was taken away by the Arizona Supreme Court. They determined that they didn't like that way of raising the funding for our school. So we,
and it wasn't just taken away by the Supreme Court. I mean, it was driven. An effort that was driven clearly by the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's where it came from. But, you know, going back for a moment to business, you know, I have worked previously doing communications work for the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. So I got by osmosis a better understanding of how business shapes Arizona politics, and clearly it does. It has a major influence. The Arizona Chamber of Commerce, for instance, is a major voice in Arizona politics on a number of levels. They don't always get their way, but they are a major force. And it just strikes me that, you know, common sense would suggest that in the long run, and the long run could be 5 years from now when kids graduate from high school, it could be 10 years from now when, you know, when they're out there in the workforce, et cetera, that we have to train them. We have to train our children and educate them and give them every single tool that we possibly can if we want this economy to succeed. So it seems like they should be on your side all of the time. How do you get them to be on your side more often in terms of this, the fights that you're trying to pursue here?
I completely agree with you. And as I always say, and I strongly believe that Arizona's future starts in our school. So it's critical that we're investing in that future. And again, making sure that all kids have access to an amazing education opportunity so that then they're ready for that future workforce. So I do think another area where I would like to have more partnership from the business community is in funding early education, and especially full day kindergarten, because knowing that right now, our economy actually needs more workers. I know as I go around, everybody's hiring, schools are hiring along with the business community. We're all trying to hire people. And
massive worker shortage.
Yes. And part of how we can help people, help find more people for the workforce is actually by having more childcare options. And so by having, you know, we don't, maybe educators don't like calling preschool childcare, but it is a way for kids to be in a very warm learning environment and be developing their social skills, developing those early academic skills. Same with full day kindergarten, because the state currently only funds half day kindergarten, which is only 2 to 3 hours per day. So it's really hard, especially for parents, to work a full time job and have their kids in with limited options for preschool. And
overwhelmingly, parents work full time jobs.
Very often. And as I've traveled the state and I visit preschools, I ask them, I always ask, do you have a wait list? Because every single place I go, no matter whether it's Prescott or I was recently in San Luis, Arizona, and they always say, yes, we have a wait list of oftentimes over 100 kids. So to me, those are families, parents that want a safe place for their kids to be learning those early skills, and they are being denied access to those options. So I do think that that's an area where we need to have more partnership with the business community.
So I'm one of those folks who, when the pandemic hit and there was complaints that children are being kept home from school, you know, my basic reasoning at the time is we don't even know what's going on with this virus. It's killing thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. I don't want my child exposed to the possibility that they could get this virus that we don't know how to manage yet. And so I was one of those folks who said, yes, we need to keep them, you know, safe, keep them away from school. And then now we clearly have seen the consequences of them missing so much school, right? We shouldn't be surprised. I'm not surprised. But the solution is not to sort of say, you know, wow, you know, it was a huge mistake to try to keep our children alive, you know, because now they've suffered educationally. I think the solution is now you do everything you possibly can to help them catch up because they survived. They're alive. They're not one of the 1 million plus people out there in America who are gone now, right? So they've survived. We need to educate them. We need to get them to catch up. So how would you do that in your second term? And how does the federal government, in terms of any of its initiatives that it has, how will it play into that? How do you help these kids catch up now?
That's absolutely one of my top priorities, is continuing the work to accelerate student learning. And we started this even earlier in the pandemic with the investment from the federal government, from the COVID relief funding. Arizona has received just over $4 billion of federal funds that are dedicated to K-12 education. And so it's been the responsibility of the Department of Education to be helping our schools, and by also launching statewide initiatives to accelerate student learning. So as I've also been talking with our schools about how they're using the funding and seeing the impact of that, a lot of our schools are using it for additional specialists, like reading and math specialists. We're training teachers in all grades across, no matter whether they're in special education or general education, making sure all teachers know the science of reading to make sure that we're all effectively teaching kids how to read. And then for math, it is challenging for our schools to recruit certified math teachers, especially in rural parts of the state. So we've also partnered with ASU for a project called Math Momentum, which specifically for schools that are unable to recruit a certified math teacher and have that vacancy, the ASU program is providing that math instruction virtually. And they're providing the curriculum, and they have meetings with the teachers who are on site, but the instruction and curriculum is all being delivered virtually. And we've seen really good success with this Math Momentum initiative so far.
Are those, I mean, we saw the stories about where the scores are now, and clearly kids have suffered. Are the things that you're describing that have already happened, are they having an effect? Are they starting to work and starting to bring these kids back to some semblance of parity with their previous scores?
Yes. Yeah, so giving a little context of where we're at academically, Arizona students took our statewide assessment In 2020, or sorry, not in 2020 because of the pandemic, but they took the state assessment in 2021 and then again in 2022. And in 2021 is when we saw the most devastating impacts of the pandemic, because by and large, most students were at home for a good portion of that school year from 2020 to 2021. But most of our students took the state assessment in 2021, and that's where we saw the most devastating impacts of the pandemic. Then this year in 2022, when they took the assessments again, we actually saw growth. We went up 3% in reading and 2% in math, which is actually better than what most of the country is seeing, because we have actually seen nationwide, as of this year, 2022 results, the biggest drop in academic performance in over 30 years nationwide. Arizona is actually bouncing back up. And I do think it's because of the strategic use of our funding. Of course, the amazing hard work of our teachers and parents working together to get kids caught up and accelerate their learning. But then nationally, we recently also just saw our NAEP scores, which is the national assessment that's given. And it showed that actually Arizona stayed steady in reading. And then we did have a bigger decline in math, but it was commensurate with what other states had for the decline in math. But we actually did better than other states in reading. Actually, we were 10% better than New Mexico. So I don't want to throw New Mexico under the bus, but Arizona is actually, we've been holding steady, and we do need to keep focused on that math, seeing that that's where there's been the most serious decline, but that is what we're seeing across the country nationwide. So we are starting to see our work and our investments paying off.
And you said there was about $4 billion in federal pandemic funding that came into the state. What about going forward? How do you fund the ability to continue or expand these initiatives?
So that funding is actually, it's goes through the fall of 2024. So it's not all spent yet.
Okay. So yeah. So there's still that available. And then this is a long-term problem though, right? You've been a teacher, you run this department now. How long is it going to take us do you believe to catch our kids up? And along the same line of questioning, what about those children of color in low-income schools that haven't done as good a job oftentimes educating our children?
It's hard to put an exact timeline on that, but I will say that those federal funds are allocated using the Title I formula, which is based on poverty. So schools that have the highest number of kids, and how they determine that is based on kids who qualify for free and reduced lunch, that those schools receive the most funds, and also then again based on the number of students in the schools. But we've also launched statewide initiatives, including we've worked both with the legislature and using the federal funds to add hundreds more mental health professionals to our schools. So those are the school counselors and social workers, which is also a huge component, especially for kids living in poverty who have, you know, may have gone through traumatic experiences, because kids need to be emotionally ready to learn before they can do well in their academics. And so I've heard time and time again from our school leaders that once they have a school counselor or a social worker, they tell me, we must have this at every school. This position is so critical. The need is so great for our kids and for our families that these positions are just essential now. And so I'm really proud of our work that we've been able to accomplish to add hundreds of mental health professionals. And we've reduced our student to school counselor ratio by 20% already.
That's really significant. And the work they're doing is not just, of course, being there in the time of need with children who perhaps had to go through the isolation of the pandemic, and their families had to go through the economic challenges that they had to endure as well. But of course, we still have this horrendous problem with school shootings all over the country. And even if it hasn't happened at your local school, if you're a child and you go home and you see it on television that in Uvalde, 17 children, you know, were killed, it permeates, right? These are children who in this generation think about this. And we need counselors there. We need professionals there to help them through this, don't we?
Yes, definitely. And, you know, as a new mom and thinking about the priorities for my second term, school safety must be our number one priority, because I think all parents believe that having trust in that our schools will be a safe place for our kids is the number one concern for parents and families. So I do think more needs to be done in this area. I did launch the school safety task force after the Parkland shooting back in 2019, but there's more work to be done in this area. And our schools are asking for more resources and help so that they can do things like risk assessments and have school safety plans. There's just definitely more work to be done in this area.
Yeah. And if you don't mind, just a couple more questions and we'll close out, because I know you have a busy campaign schedule. One of the things that I think is also part of the context of for children these days, and especially children of color, has been a kind of, and you alluded to this earlier, really a kind of assault on the idea of parity, the idea of equity, the idea that children of color deserve to have equity in a school system and be treated with respect, and that the historical factors that kind of led to so many of the consequences that they've had to live through today, there's an attack on that. The idea that we shouldn't talk about slavery, we shouldn't talk about segregation, we shouldn't talk about mass deportations over the decades, because somehow it's I don't understand the logic of it, frankly, myself, as someone who loves history and understands that we have to learn from history. But that kind of diatribe, that kind of constant drumbeat, I think has an effect on our children. I mean, it essentially says to them, your history doesn't matter. Your history isn't valued. What are your thoughts on that in terms of what you do day to day as a superintendent?
Well, yeah, this is unfortunately also not a new issue. We know my opponent, who I'm running against, was one of the main leaders attacking the Mexican American Studies program in the Tucson Unified School District. They banned the program, and then that was, after a lengthy lawsuit, that was ultimately determined to be unconstitutional because they determined that that was both politically and racially motivated. And so this is not the first time that our school districts have been attacked for their efforts to have curriculum where our students can see themselves in the curriculum and have understand their own history, their own culture, and to relate to that in a way that strengthens their self-identity. And actually that program, the Mexican American Studies program, was so successful that it actually improved graduation rates. There were less students dropping out. They were academically performing higher, even in math, which was a surprise to the researchers.
The most heartbreaking thing, honestly, looking back at that whole incident, was the fact that children's scores and graduation rates were improving over the course of years, and then just all got wiped out. Yes. And, you know, and it's heartbreaking to imagine the kids that didn't graduate as a result of the program being, you know, wiped out. And, you know, when I think about sort of my schooling, my education, you know, we had none of that. We weren't taught about the history of people of color in America and the influences that we had and so forth. It was there were so many things that I had to learn in college and then much later after that. But having learned about, for instance, the existence of Governor Raul H. Castro, right, or having learned about the woman who was a journalist in Laredo, Texas, who fought, you know, for free speech and who's now going to be honored, I think, with a stamp or, you know, something along those lines soon, or just having learned about people who did significant things in the Latino community and frankly, in the Black community or in the Native American community and did amazing things and amazing accomplishments that we never talked about before. Those things inspire me. And so I assume they'll inspire, you know, young children of color growing up. You know, why the animosity against it? And clearly your opponent doesn't like that. Why is that a problem to teach our children their own history?
Well, I see it the way you see it. And I think ultimately it's a distraction for him to say that CRT is his number one priority. I think is a way to build distrust and fear in our community of worrying about what's being taught in our public
and something education. That isn't even taught in our public
Correct.
School system.
It's not even being taught, but it's ultimately just an attack on our public education system. That's why I just keep staying laser focused on the issues that Arizona families are telling me that they care most deeply about, like the teacher recruitment and retention, school safety, and the mental health and well-being of our kids.
Kathy Hoffman is the incumbent after almost 4 years as state school superintendent in Arizona, and she's running as a Democrat. against the Republican Tom Horn, who is out there somewhere, hopefully listening to this, and maybe we'll come on the show and defend sort of his positions as well. Kathy, I want to thank you so much for taking your time out of your busy day, and we'll get this on our program this weekend and then up as a podcast later. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, James.